Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Congress in 1990 established the original list of 180 hazardous air pollutants and empowered the Environmental Protection Agency to expand that list when necessary. But it wasn't until this year that the EPA, for the first time in three decades, expanded the list to include a compound considered too harmful to breathe. And the addition only came after years of persistent lobbying by environmentalists and decades after the compound was found, even by some chemical companies, to be a dangerous airborne pollutant. We're talking today about the process by which the EPA expanded the list of hazardous air pollutants and why it appears to take so long, in this case, over the course of three presidencies. Dino Grandoni covers the Environmental Protection Agency, climate change, and other environmental issues for The Washington Post. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So what's the compound that's now been added to the list?
Yeah, so we're talking about a chemical called 1-bromopropane, which is a kind of long name for a chemical that's been used for lots of different purposes. I think the best known one is probably as a dry cleaning solvent, but it has other uses too. It's been used in auto shops, furniture factories, and it is very good at getting out grease and other kind of difficult, cleaning greasy metal parts and dirty fabrics. But it also has some profound health effects.
Right. We know environmental groups have been lobbying for 30 years to get this taken care of. Who's been against it?
Well, the manufacturers of the chemicals, but really you have a lot of chemical companies who have made alternatives who actually initiated this push in the first place. An industry group called the Halogenated Solvents Industry Alliance teamed up with the state of New York to petition the EPA to add it to the list of hazardous chemicals a decade ago. But this it took a decade for this decision to finally be made.
What obligation does the EPA have to explain itself on these kind of cases?
Well, it has to. That's a good question. It has to consider these petitions when they get them. And it is supposed to make a decision within 18 months. But as you noted at the top, this whole process spanned three presidencies.
Yeah. All right. So when they fall short of that 18-month goal, no consequences then?
Well, you'd have to ask the advocates what they want, they had done in response, but there might be potential there for the administration or the agency to be sued in that case.
Okay, since they fell short of that 18-month thing, because this is dangerous. What's so dangerous about this chemical? And it happens to be usually like so many chemicals affect certain groups of people more than others.
Right. Well, it's dangerous to breathe, and it was included on this list of hazardous air chemicals that includes mercury and lead. And it has been suspected to damage nerves and to cause cancer. And there have been reports from furniture factories in North Carolina of people having these profound health effects from working with the chemical for years and years, episodes of dizziness and difficulty moving.
Three presidencies came and went before this was added to the list. Do politics play much of a role in all of this?
I'm sure they do. We don't have a complete view of what the political decisions were around this specific chemical. But I will say the Trump administration was known to slow walk some of this stuff. But again, a petition was originally filed under Obama. So it really speaks to the kind of bureaucratic inertia that a lot of government agencies, including the EPA, can have.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the process by which the Environmental Protection Agency expands its list of hazardous air pollutants. The Congress in 1990 established the original list of 180, but it wasn't until this year that the EPA, for the first time in three decades, expanded that list to include a compound considered too harmful to breathe. We've been talking about that with Dino Grandoni. He covers the Environmental Protection Agency, climate change, and other environmental issues for the Washington Post. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Dino, is it like an, obviously it's just an arm of the EPA that does this. Is this an office, is an agency within it? Who are these people?
I believe it's the Office of Air, but yeah, it's the it's the EPA. That's the agency that's making this decision.
So, but is it a group of people somewhere in the EPA? I'm trying to get a handle on the human element here. Are we talking about a lot of people? I mean, we're talking about three different presidencies over 30 years. Were the same people even in play in this office throughout this?
Well, yeah, there are certainly career folks that stay at the agency in all sorts of roles, whether it's air or water or land pollution that span multiple presidencies. Yeah.
When Congress established the list in 1990, what was intended there? Did they expect this a 30-year wait before there'd be an addition, or what was the anticipation there?
What I've been told is that Congress was supposed to make this into an easy process. This wasn't supposed to be a difficult thing to do. In 1990, lawmakers recognized that they did not have a complete list of every single compound that can go into the air and give humans bad health effects. So they empowered the EPA to make these decisions quickly. Supposed to be in a year and a half after getting a petition to add it to the list or not, and then after that to regulate it. But that just isn't how the law has worked in practice.
And do we know why?
I mean, fundamentally, no. I don't know why. You'd have to ask the agency why it has taken so long.
And are there other compounds? Are there other chemicals that are in the same position as this one that they haven't taken action on? Have there been other petitions?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question, and yes, there is. Public health advocates are hopeful that this move by the EPA is a harbinger for adding other chemicals to the list. And the set of chemicals that they mention is polyfluorinated and perfluorinated compounds called PFAS, P-F-A-S, which some of your listeners have probably heard of. This is a set of chemicals. There's some kinds called quote-unquote forever chemicals that are used in a lot of nonstick products like Teflon and used as a firefighting foam at a lot of military bases. But they persist in the environment for years and years and can build up in the bodies of organisms, including humans, and are thought to cause cancer. It's a major concern for many communities around the country and increasingly for lawmakers. So there is a push now to have some of those PFAS added to the toxic, the air toxics list.
And I take it the EPA still didn't make that 18-month deadline.
No, we are waiting and seeing for that.
That's the movie like that Dark Waters was, I mean, the story about Dark Waters.
Precisely, yes. Yeah. That was a depiction of chemical pollution in West Virginia, I think at the West Virginia-Ohio border, that concerned PFAS from, I believe, DuPont.
What role does Congress play in all of this?
Well, Congress has empowered the EPA to act, and it is failing to do so. So Congress can step in and write another law, but the political climate is much different today than it was in 1990. It is hard to imagine this Congress passing some sort of update to the Clean Air Act, which is the law we're talking about here. It was originally passed in the 70s. It received its major update in 1990, and that's that's what we're talking about here. This list of chemicals was codified in 1990. There hasn't been an update to that law since. In particular, there hasn't been an update to that law to address climate change specifically. It is, yeah, like I said, difficult to imagine this Congress at this moment passing mustering the 60 votes they need to get a law through the Senate to pass such a law.
Right. So now that this one bromopropane, 1BP, has been added to the list, what's next? What's the next step? Is it that's it? It's banned or what?
No, it's not banned. Its uses will be regulated, and we have to wait to see what the agency will do specifically to try to curb its use and to try to curb its buildup in the air.
And what kind
this of is a very this is very much a first step to be added to the list, but it's not the end.
And what kind of time frame going forward are we on?
That's a good question for the agency. I don't know offhand.
They don't have any particular timeline that they're mandated to follow.
Again, I would have to check. I'm not sure what the timeline is for one bromopropane.
So there's other additions in the works. Again, it's kind of unclear. Covering the EPA is murky job.
That's well put. Yes. You know, it's an agency that is difficult to pierce. They're in a big moment of transition right now, though. We are at about the one-year mark for the new administration. The Biden team has tried to get a lot of new rulemaking off the ground outside of one bromopropane to address emissions from cars that are causing climate change, from air conditioners that are warming the planet, from coal plants that are distributing wastewater. Mm-hmm. So it's a big moment for the agency to do this, to try to get all this stuff done within 4 or maybe 8 years, mm-hmm. Especially after 4 years under Trump, in which the staff felt demoralized and felt it difficult to do the job.
Well, Dino Grandoni, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Dino Grandoni covers the Environmental Protection Agency, climate change, and other environmental issues for The Washington Post. We'll continue our conversation about the issue of hazardous air pollutants, what it takes to get on the official list of the EPA. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're looking at the environmental issue of hazardous air pollutants, how they have been regulated in the past, and how that regulation very occasionally gets updated, the EPA, for the first time in 30 years, has expanded a list of 180 hazardous air pollutants to include a compound considered too harmful to breathe. It's one that's commonly used in dry cleaning. Cinnamon Carlarn is an associate dean and law professor at the Ohio State Moritz College of Law. Her scholarship focuses on the evolution of domestic and international environmental law. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to have something positive to talk about.
Yeah, it is a switch. But, you know, my last guest said that the process by which these things happen is kind of elusive. This is just the first step in a very long process to start to actually regulate this compound. This all ties back to the Clean Air Act, which was initially enacted in 1963. What was it meant to address back then? What's the origin story?
Yeah, so the origin story of the Clean Air Act is really fascinating. So it's true that it existed in the 1960s, but the Clean Air Act as we know it, that really empowered the federal government and the EPA, really only dates back to 1970. And so in 1970, the idea was, you know, we really need to clean up our air. We've got huge air pollution problems. And so we began targeting what we can think of as conventional air pollution, lead, ozone, particulate matter, sulfur dioxide. And then the Clean Air Act's been amended twice since then, substantively in 1977 and 1990. And we're still really working to clean up primary air pollution and just getting our hand around, you know, things like hazardous air pollution 30 plus years later.
So the Clean Air Act was then enacted in 1963, and that's before the EPA even existed, right?
That's right. And in 1963, it didn't really empower the federal government to do much except facilitate some of the work that the states were trying to do through funding and through support. And so it was really in 1970 when the Clean Air Act was amended and the same year the EPA was created that we think that we see the kind of the regime that we have now where the federal government has the power to identify pollutants, to set standards, and then where the EPA has the ability to create air pollution standards that then the states have to implement. So before 1970, the federal government didn't have the power to really force the states to address air pollution.
All right, so let's take the case of this compound, 1BP, 1-bromopropane. It's a degreaser, kind of a solvent used commonly as well in dry cleaning. It took 30 years from the time that it was first identified as a potential problem, and then 10 years later was the first petition, I guess, 20 years ago. It took 20 years. What kind of obligation does the EPA have to follow any kind of timeline with these kinds of issues?
Yeah, there's a lot of timelines built into the Clean Air Act. And technically, under Section 112, with respect to petitions, you know, anybody can petition to list a new hazardous air pollutant. They just have to meet certain guidelines. They basically have to show that this pollutant poses a risk to human health. And the EPA is supposed to respond to that petition to either deny it or grant it within 18 months. So that the first petition that we're actually talking about here was really filed in 2011. So, you know, over a decade ago.
Okay.
But of course, what happened was they said that the petition was incomplete. And so there was a period of years in which the petition was basically being completed. And they said, okay, it's completed in 2015. And then from 2015 onwards, it starts this process. So there's a lot of deadlines built into the Clean Air Act, but they tend to get elongated in different kinds of ways.
Okay, so 18 months is pie in the sky.
Pie in the sky. I mean, the reality is that there's a couple of really important points here. I mean, the Clean Air Act itself hasn't been amended since 1990. So we're working with a very old statute as it is. Uh-huh. And so we're trying to do a lot of work under that statute. And then EPA, you know, every time they get a petition to list a hazardous air pollutant or to, you know, update a conventional air pollutant standard, it's incredibly slow. We are behind the science always.
How many petitions are out there anyway? I mean, is there any reliable source on that?
You know, it's funny because I was actually tried to look at that after I, you know, was following this petition. And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know how many petitions have been denied. I don't know how many are pending out there. I know that there's efforts to, address forever chemicals and have, PFASs and others and have those listed, where they are in the process, what's going to happen. It is a very, it's very difficult to know.
What kind of liability does the EPA have when it doesn't take action in a timely manner? By way of these timelines?
Yeah, I mean, so from an administrative law perspective, petitioners can challenge the EPA's failure to respond or the failure to respond in a timely way. That'll generally end up in the courts and end up with, you know, a lot of litigation and a slow process. So there are certain ways to try to push, but it's all pretty slow, whether we're thinking about just administrative response or the litigation trying to force the administrative response.
Our knowledge of air pollution, as you said, has advanced light years ahead of what's going. Well, you didn't say light years, but I'm saying it ahead of what the EPA is doing. Is it sort of like this giant agency that just has a hard time moving quickly? Or what kind of pressures are brought to bear to stop it from moving more quickly?
Oh, I mean, a lot of it is political And then resources. I mean, so we have the Clean Air Act and the EPA that's trying to do the work of addressing conventional air pollution. You know, the pollution we've known about since the 1960s, we're still trying to get a handle on it from fossil fuel plants, from automobiles. We've identified new hazardous air pollutants like the one that was just listed, plus dozens of others we're not yet regulating, on top of which the Clean Air Act is used as the vehicle to address ozone pollution and ozone depletion and climate change, right? This is the big one. So we're trying to do a huge amount of work with an old statute with the EPA that has limited resources, and on top of which everything they try to do gets pushback. And then this is really important, what the EPA does and doesn't do is very, very much determined by whoever is in the executive branch. So with each different president, the EPA has different mandates. And what that means is we have a tremendous amount of push and pull to list, don't list, address climate change, don't address climate change. So, you know, we have an old statute, tons of problems, limited resources, and a huge amount of political flux.
And a Congress that can't
do anything.
Find its napkin at the table right now. They can't get pretty much anything done. So the limited resources issue, I'm interested in that. Is that the appropriations for EPA? That comes through Congress, right?
That's correct.
Are they stingy?
I mean, they tend to be stingy. And I mean, you've actually had efforts, for example, during the Trump administration to defund certain EPA programs. So there were efforts to defund the EPA in ways that would have limited their ability to actually regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Those largely failed. But every year, EPA is saying, you know, what's our budget, basically? And this is true across environmental law. Fish and Wildlife Services struggles with this as well. And then it's just human power as well. I mean, this is an agency that is doing a lot of work that we see, but a lot of work that we don't see, the hardworking agency.
What role do the states play in all of this?
Yeah, so the way that the Clean Air Act works is it's a system of cooperative federalism. And so essentially under this is kind of very 10,000 foot, but under the Clean Air Act, what happens is the federal government through the EPA will set identify criteria air pollutants or big air pollutants, identify hazardous air pollutants, set standards for them, but then give the states a tremendous amount of flexibility in how to meet and kind of comply with those standards. And so the idea is that we have these baselines or floors that the EPA, the federal government, sets, but then the states have some flexibility in how they meet those standards based on their different circumstances.
And besides appropriations, what role does Congress play?
I mean, Congress, of course, you know, Congress wrote the Clean Air Act. Congress has amended the Clean Air Act. Congress has the power to, you know, further amend the Clean Air Act or adopt other statutes in this regard. But their silence in this space means that the primary control they have is over, direct limitations on EPA power through appropriations and other means. And then the executive, again, has a tremendous amount of power because of the way that administrative agencies work. And because the EPA has so much power and so much responsibility, given kind of congressional inaction.
So the Trump administration tried to roll back EPA's reach and failed, but still that hamstrung the agency for a while. It looks like the Biden administration, to wit this the compound that we're talking about today, is trying to move ahead on multiple different issues, including greenhouse gases. What about the Obama administration?
So, I mean, the Obama administration, especially during the second term, really tried to push, in particular, efforts on climate change forward, but largely through executive actions again. So, whether it was President Obama, President Trump, President Biden, we haven't seen any president successfully kind of mobilize executive power to get the Congress to do anything. But what we have seen both President Obama do and President Biden do is try to use executive power in a variety of ways to kind of use the purchasing power of the federal government to incentivize, clean energy, to move towards, a clean vehicle fleet, to have federal buildings use clean energy. So you've seen both President Obama and President Biden both really try to draw upon their executive authority to push us in the right direction. But of course, because all of that is just executive based, it's not legislative, it was so easy to roll back. Not easy, but relatively easy to roll back during the Trump administration, which means we're kind of constantly trying to keep up.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the EPA and its original list of 180 hazardous air pollutants. It was all established in Congress in 1990. The EPA has been empowered to expand that list when necessary, but it hasn't until now. For the first time in three decades, it expanded it to include a compound considered too harmful to breathe. But this is only the first step in another set of processes to start to regulate and control the emissions of this compound. My guest is Cinnamon Carlarn. She's an associate dean and law professor at OSU Moritz College of Law. Her scholarship focuses on the evolution of domestic and international environmental law. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Professor Carlarn, how does the U.S. stack up? We usually think of air pollution these days as, you know, involving China or India or, you know, populous but still developing countries. What about the U.S.?
Well, just in terms of air quality, we've made huge strides since 1970. I mean, I always want to give the United States a lot of credit for really developing kind of really effective forms of environmental law. You know, our Clean Air Act and some of our other environmental laws have become models that are used worldwide. So we have done a lot to clean up our air. You know, even cities like LA that really still struggle with air pollution are dramatically better than they were, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and much better than they would have been in the absence of the Clean Air Act. However, we still struggle to meet very basic controls on conventional air pollution. We're still beginning to list hazardous air pollution, and you know, our existing regime does almost nothing to address, you know, our most, you know, pressing contemporary air quality challenge, which is climate change. Right. So we've made a huge strides with the laws we have. And if we had a Congress that was willing to kind of keep building on those and offering tools, we could do a lot more. But we still have, you know, millions of people who live in areas where air quality is determined to be below very basic standards, at least parts of the year.
And often when we're talking about these compounds, these chemicals that could whether it's the forever chemicals or the one we've been talking about today, more particularly I'm looking for the name of it right now.
Oh, bromopropane.
Yeah. 1 BP. Yeah. People are familiar with as a solvent, a degreaser. It's also used in something is, you know, that we take for granted is dry cleaning. That's been known for a long, long time, the dry cleaning problem. They tend to affect more certain populations more than others, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the really kind of very significant challenges we have in the United States and really around the world, but especially in the United States from our perspective, are challenges related to environmental justice and environmental racism, because very often, whether we're talking about hazardous waste sites, water quality or air quality, the communities that bear the brunt of these environmental harms often tend to be communities of color and low income communities. We've been aware of this since the 1980s. You know, we began to see efforts to address this under the Clinton administration, but those have been weakened. Poor. To be frank, the Biden administration is now prioritizing to a greater degree questions of environmental justice and climate justice, but we still have a huge amount of room for improvement in that regard. So we do have communities that really do continue to bear the brunt of air pollution in the United States.
Why is that? I mean, is it just because factories and so forth tend to be located in lower income neighborhoods?
Oh, I think it's a combination of factors. I think it is because you tend to have environmental polluting activities that it's easier for them to be located in those communities often because there's less political pushback. Communities have been historically excluded from the political process, have fewer tools to kind of resist the siting of those facilities, to when they are identified to kind of call them out. I mean, this is the classic case that we saw in Flint with the water crisis. This was a community that said, our water is not good, our water is not good. There were efforts to address water quality in other parts of the country, but simply not there. And so this problem of kind of historical exclusion from the political process means that these are problems that have existed for decades and we continue to kind of let sit.
And so then I go back, particularly with Flint, you know, I'm glad you raised that issue, back to the question of liability. They keep passing the buck and they can blame timelines and all kinds of stuff all they want. But the bottom line is this chemical is still being emitted. Just because it's been added to the list doesn't even make any difference at that point. There's still more processes to go before it's regulated and it's taken off the shelf.
Yeah, I mean, starting in February, there'll be some ability to control it under Clean Air Act permitting. So it's Title V permitting. It means that certain big facilities will have to control the pollutant if it's above a certain level. However, you're absolutely right that we don't even have emission standards for it yet. And to kind of develop those emission standards for this particular pollutant will take at least another year. And that's really being overly hopeful, probably much longer than that. So we'll have some tools to control it, but not many. But coming back to your question of passing the buck, I mean, the reality is that environmental law is very limited in the harms that it sees and responds to. It's very one-dimensional in terms of addressing one problem at a time. And that's why many of these kind of social and racial justice issues have simply escaped sufficient response.
Why does it take a whole nother year to establish emission standards?
Well, it's interesting. If you kind of go and read the document for this particular one, it says, you know, we still are getting our hands around kind of where it's coming from, and our control of it's going to affect different communities. So we need to go talk to those affected industries and figure out kind of get more data. You know, so there's a lot of open questions left. And so the next process will really be engage with the potentially regulated community, understand where it's coming from and how to regulate it. And this is almost always the case. I mean, we want to make good rules. And so we want information, and information deficiencies are constantly a problem. But, you know, does that justify what is probably going to be a very, again, elongated process? No.
Well, it just seems to me that finally getting it on the list, weren't they gathering data all the way along the line anyway?
Yeah, but you know, in initial stages, what EPA would tell you is that they were really focused on looking at the compound itself and the impact, the amount that's being emitted, but the impact on human health, and really looking at those studies. And then the separate question of kind of, okay, so looking nationally now at who's emitting this and what the best way to control it is related, but also a distinct question. And so that's why those steps are often bifurcated, because the first part, we do really just want to focus on the human health impacts of the chemical or the hazardous air pollutant in this case. And then the second one from a regulation perspective is a little different, not unrelated, but a little different.
So to what extent do politics play a role in setting emission standards now?
Yeah, so politics always play a role. I mean, it's interesting. The Clean Air Act is designed to basically exclude economics and politics from certain parts of the process. Right. So, you know, does this chemical affect human health? Yes. Okay. But then in the process of setting the standard, then questions of economics come in different kinds of ways.
So it's not pure science by any stretch?
No. I would like to say it's pure science when we're, for example, identifying criteria air pollutants, identifying the standards for those, identifying whether something is in fact a hazardous air pollutant. But when it actually comes to establishing standards and creating regulatory regimes to implement those standards, of course there's politics there.
Okay. Well, Professor Cinnamon Carlarn is an associate dean and law professor at OSU Moritz College of Law. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. It was a pleasure to be here.
We have more coming up. We're going to hear from some of those environmental advocacy groups that pushed for this addition to the list of hazardous air chemicals. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For the first time in 30 years, the EPA added a chemical to its list of hazardous air pollutants, 1-bromopropane, also known as 1-BP, which is a common commercial degreasing solvent also used in the dry cleaning process. Tosh Sagar is a senior attorney with the nonprofit Public Interest Environmental Law Organization, Earth Justice, a pipe manufacturer has repeatedly... Welcome to the show, Tosh. I'm sorry.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
A pipe manufacturer has repeatedly released the chemical in the black majority city of Birmingham, Alabama. Michael Hansen is executive director of the Greater Birmingham Alliance to Stop Pollution, or GASP. In 2020, Earth Justice sued the EPA on behalf of GASP, among others, to compel the agency to add 1BP to the list of hazardous air pollutants. Michael Hansen, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Your organization was founded in response to local air pollution issues. What was going on?
Yeah, Birmingham is a steel town. It was founded in the late 1800s on the back of iron and steel industries. And as such, we've had air quality issues since the founding of the city. And though we've made progress over the last few decades, in 2005, Birmingham ranked at the top of the rankings nationally for poor air quality. So some folks got together and said, we need to do something about this, and founded GASP.
To what extent is the one bromopropane a piece of this?
Well, the facility you mentioned in your intro, American Cast Iron Pipe Company, or American, is located right near a Superfund site in this heavy industrial part of town. And it's one of many toxic chemicals that residents in that area are exposed to. Others include benzene, naphthalene, toluene, other carcinogenic chemicals and solvents that can really, really do damage to people's health.
How does the history of Birmingham play into this?
It's a huge factor. When you're looking at old maps of zoning laws, in particular in the early to mid 1900s, you see the areas that I'm talking about used to be zoned for Black people only as part of the racial zoning laws during the Jim Crow era. And we're still dealing with that legacy today. The communities look a lot like they did back then, though there's a lot fewer steel mills now because of the manufacturing decline.
But they're brown fields nonetheless.
Yes, spotting all over the communities.
Right. Tosh, how did Earth Justice get involved in this?
Earth Justice has been working on hazardous air pollution for decades now. And so we've been very active on these provisions of the Clean Air Act. And, you know, it's been about a decade ago, a number of petitions for justice, but by others at EPA, urging EPA to add 1BP to the list of hazardous air pollutants. We saw that, and, you know, we understood the impact it would have on our clients like GASP in Birmingham and other communities around the country. This is a very widely used chemical and lots of industrial facilities in dry cleaners. And so we started advocating in front of EPA. You saw about a decade of delay across the Obama EPA and the Trump EPA. And so we brought suit on behalf of GASP and others to force this action.
What is your understanding? I mean, when you say a decade of delay, when we're talking about a hazardous air pollutant, it sounds like, I mean, there's generation after generation of children growing up around this stuff, right? So a decade of delay, how do they explain that?
They don't. I don't think they've ever tried to explain why that is, right? So these petitions were filed in 2010 and 2011. And under the law, they had 18 months to grant these petitions. As one of my colleagues, a professor at Michigan State, Adam Finkel, said, this is the easy one. This was so obvious. It should have been done in that 18 months. And then they just took over 10 years to get it done. And they didn't really offer any explanation. You know, the best they said was, this is the first time we've tried to do this, right? They've never added another one, even though there are lots of other potential haps that they could be going out and regulating. They've never done one until now, and they use that as the excuse. I think what I would say is we all want clean air, but sometimes EPA doesn't prioritize that. You know, this office in EPA that is supposed to regulate hazardous air pollutants, of which there are some like 180 or so, things like lead, mercury, we have to sue them constantly because they're falling behind. There are very clear congressional deadlines for regulation, and Earth Justice is suing them all the time, year in, year out, because they're constantly missing these deadlines to protect us from these toxic pollutants. And so this is just one more example of kind of that pattern of failure that exists at the EPA on these issues?
You know, I was just talking to the OSU Moritz College of Law professor, who for whom this is a specialty issue, and she says that it's an underfunded, under-resourced agency that it's dealing with really, at this point, antiquated law processes. Tosh.
I think if we could get more resources, and that would be the thing that triggered EPA, this office within EPA, to start acting aggressively to protect people, that would be great.
Does this feel like some kind of tipping point then, now that they've got, they've made, put on one new compound on the list in 30 years, there might be more coming, since, as you said, there's a lot of others out there?
I mean, we certainly hope so. And we definitely have been saying to EPA and to the public that there are opportunities here, clear opportunities to build on this as a precedent. I'm happy to give like kind of one example. Are you familiar with what are known as PFAS chemicals, PFAS?
The forever chemicals. Black water. Dark waters. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. There was that movie.
Yeah. We had the author on a couple years ago. Yeah.
Oh, great. So, this is for your listeners who may not be as familiar. It's a class of chemicals. I think there are several hundred, the numbers vary, but I've heard something like 600 plus in commerce. They're used all over the country. They've sampled Americans. 95% of Americans have this stuff in our blood. They're super toxic. They are an air pollutant. They get out, there's a chemical facility across the border in Parkersburg, West Virginia. They found dozens of these things coming out of the smokestacks there, right? This stuff is really toxic in really small doses. It's associated with cancer, associated with male infertility. Now they're seeing decreased immune responses. Think about, we're in a COVID pandemic. That means the vaccines don't perform as well if you've been exposed to this stuff potentially. So this is something where it's clearly toxic at low doses, comes out as an air pollutant. EPA could be moving to regulate these, and we're encouraging them to do so. So that's a great example of how EPA can start being aggressive and build on this.
Michael Hansen, in Birmingham, what has the impact been on the community? It must have be a story out there.
Yeah, certainly. And going back to the description I gave you earlier, the residents of this area are living with multiple industrial facilities in their backyard. And so as Tosh described, this decade of delay, you know, that's just adding insult to injury, because these folks are living with what we call cumulative impacts. So the impact of the coke plant or the steel mill and the pipe fitting plant. And so all of these chemicals add up. And over time, what you end up with is health disparities. All the social determinants of health are pointing in one direction for this community, and it's the wrong direction. And so this is just a big a part of that problem that the residents are facing.
OSU professor also said that now it's got to go to the emissions standard process, which could take at least a year, she said, under the best of circumstances. Tosh, I mean, what about that? And then there's probably other timelines after that. I mean, what is your expectation that this is ever going to, or when this regulation reaches a useful place?
Yeah. So I think the short answer is we don't know exactly right now what the timing is going to be. EPA has announced that they're going to be doing some more in the early spring to kind of give us a better sense of how they plan to proceed. Obviously, given the toxicity of this chemical, its widespread use, we think they should be moving as fast as they can. And given the decade of delay, maybe even faster than they can. I think the short answer is, right, that was the reason they needed to act a decade ago, is because it does take some time to set standards. I think there are going to be some immediate impacts that will cause pollution reductions at some of the biggest facilities. A lot of industrial facilities emit multiple regulated hazardous air pollutants, And because of the amount and the fact that 1BP now gets counted in sort of the aggregate emissions that they're putting out, they're going to have to, some of those big facilities are probably going to have to make some cuts. So that will be helpful to communities. You'll see some pretty near-term cuts in pollution, but in terms of standards that directly address 1BP, it could take a minute. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's disappointing.
Michael Hansen, and the companies, the manufacturing facilities in Birmingham that are still spewing this stuff out, what is their response to this? Are they going to voluntarily just start cutting these emissions?
I wish that were the case. I don't know how they're going to respond to it before the rules come out, but what I can say is we know that these facilities like to, their arms twisted, it seems. I've completely lost my train of thought.
Well, that's okay. If you get it back, we have a few minutes, but let me ask you this in the meantime. What sort of liability does the government have for these delays, given the toxic nature of these hazardous air pollutants, Michael Hansen? I mean, is there any recourse going forward for people who are suffering because of it?
You've just touched on a really interesting topic, and I can't speak for Earth Justice or any of the other clients mm-hmm. here, but what I can say about what we're dealing with here in Birmingham is a government that has been complicit in via zoning laws and via other regulations and or lack of enforcement across industries, not just in this one case. And so in that way, I would say that the local, state, and federal governments have been complicit in the harm done. Now, what that means on a legal basis, I have no idea, but I can say that morally, I find it reprehensible.
Is there a page to be torn from the pages of Flint, Michigan?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, and the decade of delay is very similar to what we saw in Flint with the government's slow action and failure to respond.
Tosh Sagar?
I agree that, you know, it's very reminiscent of Flint, and probably there are other tragedies like this across the country where the government just leaves people to the mercy of polluters, even though it has an obligation to do something. Whether there's a lawsuit or a legal action to be had, I'm not sure.
So, Tosh, it just goes to the emissions standards phase, development phase at this point. And another thing that the law professor at OSU said is that politics plays a role in that too. This is not pure science.
I think it's gonna go to the setting emission standards, and your friend at OSU is certainly correct that, you know, what should be a science and health-based standard setting process, which is what the statute requires, set standards to protect public health, has often been riddled with politics, both at the agency level in terms of the rule writers, but then when it gets into the courts, I think, you know, under the Obama EPA, they tried to put out standards for mercury from power plants. And I think the Supreme Court got involved in a way that was very political and stopped those rules. So so I think, you know, yeah, you can't escape politics when it comes to protecting people. And that's so often why that the people with the least political power, the least wealth, are often bearing the brunt of these terrible toxic pollutants.
And in the meantime, Michael Hansen, now that it's on the list, everybody knows clearly that this is a big problem. How can people protect themselves in Birmingham?
One of the things that people can do is when they smell something, see something, say something, mm-hmm. we really encourage people to report pollution concerns to the local health department and or to the state agency that regulates pollution. And I suspect the same goes across all of the states as well.
Michael Hansen, Executive Director of the Greater Birmingham Alliance to Stop Pollution, GASP. Thanks so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And Tash Sagar, a senior attorney with the nonprofit public interest environmental law organization, Earth Justice. Thanks for your time as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne. It was a pleasure. Appreciate you having us on.
You bet. And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.